Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. In the last half hour, we talked with Bernie Siegel of the Genetics Policy Institute about his work on embryonic stem cells, and I wanted to read a little bit from this excellent article in Nature magazine published on December 8th, 2004. It's a review of, the title is Religion and Science, Studies of Faith, and it's a review by David Reichart, David Cyronoski, and Quirin Scheiermeyer. When Pope John Paul II addressed the Pontifical Academy of Sciences in 1992, he tackled yet again Galileo's famous battles with the Church four centuries ago. In his talk, entitled Faith Can Never Conflict with Reason, the Pope was doing his best to mend fences. Although science and religion form two realms of knowledge, he said, the two realms are not altogether foreign to each other. They have points of contact. Despite the Pope's optimistic words, the tension between faith and science never fully subsides. And as these realms regularly come into contact over everything from Darwin to Dolly, the cloned sheep, they sometimes collide with explosive force. Today, with scientists manipulating the machinery of life as never before, the debate is in full swing. Nanotechnology, artificial intelligence, cloning, creationism, and genetic modification all test the strained relationship between faith and advancing technology. Today's frontline controversy, stem cell research, has prompted a wide range of reactions from religious leaders, much of it negative. But the fundamental religion-based belief in the sanctity of human life, even at the stage of an embryo, clashes in this field with another fundamental human desire to alleviate suffering and cure disease. The debate does not leave room for simple answers for individuals or society as a whole. Francis Collins, head of the U.S. National Human Genome Research Institute in Bethesda, Maryland, and a devout Christian, has described himself as being intensely conflicted over stem cell research. Quote, it's a classic example of a collision between two very important principles, he says. The opposition to stem cell research cannot be dismissed as merely anti-science. Most religious traditions sincerely value medicine and science and make a serious effort to reconcile scientific thinking with doctrine. This process of discussion and reconciliation may even be initiating a fundamental change. Some Catholics are beginning to hope that recent insights into developmental biology could move the Church from its 135-year-old position that human life begins at conception, the main obstacle to it accepting the study of stem cells extracted from human embryos. Much of the theological debate about stem cell research centers on the question of when life begins. Some traditions, including most sects of Judaism and Islam, aren't troubled by this because they don't consider the early embryo fully human. Most Jewish Talmudic scholars, for example, argue that ensoulment takes place 40 days or more into pregnancy, once the human form is roughly established. Before that, the embryo is described as, quote, water. Israel accepts embryonic stem cell research, and the Israeli Academy of Sciences and the Jewish Rabbinical Assembly, headquartered in the United States, have both come out in favor. Likewise, researchers at the Royan Institute in Tehran have developed stem cell lines with the full blessing of Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. According to Hinduism, life begins at conception, but this does not make for easy decisions on the ethics of stem cell research. Destruction of an embryo could still be justified if it's considered to be an extraordinary, unavoidable circumstance and an act done for the greater good, says Swami Tyagananda, Hindu chaplain at the MIT Religious Activities Center in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Based on these criteria, many traditional Hindu priests are unwilling to condone the work, but it has not provoked much opposition in India, for instance, where embryonic stem cell research is allowed. The strongest objections come from Christian sects that regard the sacrifice of an embryo, even an undifferentiated embryo, as totally unacceptable. Embryos cannot be killed, they say, any more than death row prisoners can be used in legal and lethal experiments, even if the goal is to relieve suffering in others. Evangelical Christianity relies on a specific interpretation of Scripture for its advice on this matter. Psalm 139:13, for example, says, For you created my inmost being, you knit me together in my mother's womb. In Jeremiah 1:5, God tells the prophet, "Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you," implying that Jeremiah had personhood in God's eyes even before he was an embryo. This roughly matches current Vatican thinking. The Catholic Church holds that human life is sacred from the moment of fertilization. But some Catholic theologians point out that the Church's view on the moral status of the embryo has changed over time, and may change again. In fact, scientific breakthroughs, the discovery of the mammalian ovum in 1827, and the first microscopic views of developing embryos, helped to shape the Vatican's thinking. The findings informed Pope Pius IX's decision in 1869 to abandon the Church's moral distinction between early and late-term abortions, and to call instead for full protection of life from the moment of conception. Today, the Vatican does not strictly claim that the early embryo is a person, only that it deserves respect as a potential human being, says Carlos Badate of the Autonomous University of Madrid. Badate has an unusual background as a Jesuit priest with a doctorate in molecular biology and has served on a Spanish advisory committee for bioethics. He thinks the ambiguity in Catholic thought could open a window for the Church's acceptance of embryonic stem cell research. Recent advances in developmental biology have shown that an embryo's viability depends on the cellular environment as well as its own DNA, says Badate. We cannot consider that in the early embryo there is the entire information needed to complete the process of development, he says. In predominantly Catholic Italy, attempts to find a compromise on the issue have led only to new problems. The country passed a law this year legalizing IVF despite Vatican opposition, but no embryos can be destroyed. All have to be transferred to the mother's uterus. This can increase the risk to mothers and even lead to miscarriages in the case of multiple pregnancies. Other denominations, including the Unitarian Universalists, one of the most liberal of religious groups, take more umbrage with using custom-made embryos than the leftovers from IVF. Although the Unitarian Universalist Association has no official consensus position on stem cells, its president, William Sinkford, offered his personal opinion in 2001 that there should be no ban on embryonic stem cell research. But he added, "I would contend that no human embryos should be created specifically for stem cell experimentation, thus turning human life and human reproduction into a commodity, surely a clear affront to our first principle affirming the inherent dignity of human beings." Perhaps this dignity seems all the more affronted since the resulting experiments have not so far yielded life-saving results. Damien Keown, a specialist in Buddhist ethics at Goldsmiths College in London, sums it up, quote, "Scientific curiosity seems to be the main factor motivating cloning experiments at present, and overall Buddhists are likely to be skeptical about the need for this curiosity to be satisfied at the price of destroying human life." When Seoul National University's Wu Su Kwang cloned human embryonic stem cell lines earlier this year, he cited his own Buddhist beliefs, saying that the experiments were a kind of recycling of life in line with reincarnation. Some Buddhist groups in South Korea, where Buddhists account for about a third of the population, supported him. But most Buddhist scholars say the killing of an embryo at any stage violates a central tenet that living things should not be harmed. Cloning for reproductive purposes, on the other hand, does not require destroying the embryo, and so does not itself violate Buddhist precepts. The problem is not when life is started, but when it is stopped, as in therapeutic cloning, says Keown. Dr. Huang is on shaky ground in claiming that Buddhism supports cloning without careful qualification. And skipping ahead a little bit, polls reveal mixed opinions, although a lot hinges on the wording of the question. In July 2004, Catholics for Free Choice published a poll of 2,239 Catholics nationwide and found that 72% supported allowing scientists to use stem cells obtained from very early human embryos to find cures for serious diseases such as Alzheimer's, diabetes, and Parkinson's. But polls on embryonic stem cell research often fail to mention that the research requires destroying human embryos, says Richard Dorflinger, the deputy director of U.S. Conference on Catholic Bishops, Secretariat for Pro-Life Activities. In August, the Catholic bishops released the results of their own poll. When given a choice between funding both adult and embryonic stem cell research or only work that didn't require destroying an embryo, Americans preferred the latter by 61% to 23%. One thing is certain. Everyone agrees that fundamental ethical questions underlying stem cell research, many of which transcend religion, need to be addressed. The power of these new technologies is so great that we can no longer deal with them in a vacuum. This affects everyone across the board, says Kevin Fitzgerald of Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., a Jesuit priest with PhDs in molecular genetics and bioethics. And stem cells are just the beginning. Quote, the stuff that's coming at down the pike will make this look like child's play, he says. Mixed organic matter with inorganic, one species mixed with another, everything from the molecular level on up will be fluid. Again, those were excerpts from an article in Nature magazine called Religion and Science, Studies of Faith. It was published on December the 8th, 2004, and it was by Tony Reichart, David Cyrinowski, and Quirin Shiremeyer. Some of you may remember that a while back I interviewed Dr. Stephen Bezruchka. He was the he is the director of the Population Health Forum at Washington University in Seattle, University of Washington at Seattle. And his thesis and the mission of the Population Health Forum is the advocacy of the idea that the greater equality there is in a society, the healthier the population. And he bases that on some global epidemiologic correlation research that shows that the more equal societies are the ones that, in fact, have more have greater population health. Now, in the last week, there was an article published in the British Medical Journal, the BMJ, called "Effect of Democracy on Health: Ecological Study." It's by Alvaro Franco and two other researchers at the Universidad de Alicante, Edificio de Ciencias Sociales at Alicante, Spain. So they're Spanish researchers. And I'll read you first the précis of this article from betterhumans.com. Democracy helps your health. Freedom itself seems responsible, not wealth, inequity, or public sector size. People living in democracies have better health than those who endure repressive regimes, even when a country's wealth, level of inequity, and public sector size are accounted for. So found Spanish researcher Carlos Alvarez Dardet of the Universidad de Alicante and his colleagues, who published freedom ratings to explore the effect of democracy on life expectancy and mother and infant deaths in 170 countries that represent 98% of the world's population. While the reason for the correlation is unknown, if it's confirmed, then a country's level of freedom could provide a new approach to decreasing mortality. The researchers say increasing democracy would help counteract the health impacts of such things as unequal economic resource distribution. Of the countries studied, 45% were considered free, 32% were partially free, and 24% were not free. Health was best in the free countries, second best in partially free countries, and worst in countries that weren't free. The researchers suggest that the correlation may stem from the fact that democracies typically allow more space for social networks, pressure groups, empowerment opportunities, better access to information, and better recognition by government of people's needs. And what were some of the measures of freedom that they used in their freedom rating? So there are things like elected rule, competitive parties or political groupings, opposition with actual power, self-government of minority groups or their participation in the government, freedom of expression, assembly, association, education, and religion, a system of rule of law, free economic activity, and equality of opportunity. Okay, so some of those you could challenge on a progressive basis as not being as fully realized in the United States as they should be. But in many cases, this would go against Dr. Bezruchka's and other progressives' interpretations of the data, which, since Northern Europe tends to be at the top, but Northern Europe is distinctive in many different ways, but Northern Europe tends to be at the top and tends to be more egalitarian, and places like Japan tend to be more egalitarian. The interpretation has been that egalitarianism in those societies was leading to greater population health. This analysis would suggest more that it's the overall social freedom. This would be a more libertarian or liberal democratic interpretation of the data, that there would be more of an effect from freedom on population health. So an interesting study. Take a look at it in the BMJ. It's online, the full article, "Effect of Democracy on Health, an Ecological Study." I'd also like to share a recent article by my friend George Dvorsky called Working the Conscious Canvas, The Ability to Directly Alter Subjective and Emotional Experience Will Make Mental Manipulation an Art Form, which takes a far more celebratory approach to the prospect of cognitive manipulation than very many people have taken so far. And I think he makes a pretty good case for it. So let's read a little bit of that piece. Last year in Toronto, as an outgrowth of their PhD research in biofeedback, cyborgs James Fung and Corey Manders used EEG technology to give a concert in which audience members collectively and unconsciously created music with their minds. Called Deconcert, Regenerative Music in the Key of EEG, the result was an experimental and jazz-like form of music that placed human beings in the biofeedback loop of a computational artistic process. To some, such work might seem fringe, the sort of science meets art that excites hackers, nerds, and nobody else. But to me, Deconcert was a sign of just how close we are to a new era of art, one in which developing brain technologies open the door for newer forms of artistic expression in which human consciousness and subjective experience become a canvas unto themselves. In his 1968 sci-fi classic, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep?, Philip K. Dick envisioned a machine called the Mood Organ that allowed users to dial in their desired emotional states and, through some sort of techno-voodoo, achieve it. Around the same time, Isaac Asimov, in his Foundation series, envisioned a device he called the Visisonar that could also stimulate emotions directly. And in 1970, writing in Ringworld, Larry Niven described the TASP, a device that could induce a current in the pleasure center of the brain from a distance. As with all great science fiction, these works made prescient predictions. Recent insight into the workings of the brain and the development of promising neurotechnologies are showing that mood organs and similar devices are theoretically possible. Given the pace of scientific development in this century, I believe that these types of devices should soon be within our grasp, and along with them, new modes of artistic expression and experience. Of course, what I'm talking about is in some ways nothing new. People have tried to manipulate their brain and emotional state for thousands of years. Witness the recent discovery of ancient beer in China. These include direct, indirect methods such as taking drugs and alcohol, and direct techniques such as psychosurgery. There's evidence of trepanning from Neolithic times, trepanning being the technique of drilling holes in the brain. Psychiatric shock therapy, which is still used to treat undesirable psychologies and mental illness, falls somewhere in between. These, however, are crude attempts at cognitive control, with patients not usually surviving the procedures or suffering adverse changes in personality. So are mood organs and their ilk actually possible, or will they forever be relegated to science fiction? Theoretically, they are possible, and evidence suggests that they are also technically feasible. At the physical level, emotions appear to be regulated through the amygdala, located deep inside the brain in the medial temporal lobe. The amygdala comprises several separately functioning nuclei, which are essentially electrical signal transit points. These components are necessary for fear conditioning, emotional arousal, smell, and pheromone processing. It is the amygdala that produces changes in the neuromodulator levels. In other words, if you can regulate the amygdala and its associated components, you can control emotions. Easier said than done, of course, but there are numerous ways in which this could be accomplished. So-called brain jacks would be the most direct route. External stimulation would be exceedingly challenging because the amygdala is fairly deep in the brain. As depicted in cyberpunk novels and films, perhaps most famously in The Matrix, a brain jack seamlessly interfaces with the brain into a machine. Given sophisticated neural and computer science, a brain jack could tap into the sensory cortex and feed the brain all the data that it currently receives through sensory inputs. There's nothing in the analog arena that cannot be converted into digitized or computational form for eventual processing in the brain. Another way would be to install small liquid perfusion pumps that distribute neuromodulators across the brain in the appropriate sequence and amounts, but this is an inelegant and brute force engineering solution. Essentially, the major difficulties to any of this are figuring out where to put the electrodes or pumps and what electrical dynamics, chemical dynamics, or combination thereof are required to generate the appropriate patterns to get the desired result. It's safe to assume that such a feat won't be possible without sophisticated technologies, including intelligent computer control systems, microsurgery, and possibly even molecular nanotechnology, not to mention the complete mapping of the human brain. But believe it or not, there are already devices in existence that, at a rudimentary level, perform similar tasks. Texas-based Cyberonics, for example, recently developed the vagus nerve stimulator, VNS. VNS provides seizure control for epilepsy patients using an implanted cardiac pacemaker-like device connected to the vagus nerve in the neck. Once in place, the device can be set to emit electronic pulses to the vagus nerve at preset intervals and levels. Studies have shown that approximately 50% of epileptics treated in this fashion have significant seizure reduction. Researchers working on VNS also unexpectedly discovered that stimulating the vagus nerve in this way stimulated brain regions believed to control emotions. Essentially, VNS devices could be used as implanted emotion management pacemakers. So unsurprisingly, VNS is now being considered for treating depression. There are also non-invasive approaches that show promise, devices that would make Dr. McCoy from Star Trek jealous. Transcranial magnetic stimulation, or TMS, is one such remarkable technique currently under development. TMS uses pulsed magnetic fields to produce an electrical effect. Initially developed as a diagnostic aid for neurologists, TMS devices can stimulate motor regions of the brain, inducing a twitch of the thumb that tells a neurologist that particular nerve pathways are intact. Apparently free of serious side effects, TMS can also affect brain areas involved in visual perception, memory, reaction time, speech, and mood. Where might VNS, TMS, liquid perfusion pumps, and brain jacks eventually lead? Quite obviously, potential applications lie across the board, but from the creative and recreational perspectives, the possibilities are quite fascinating. Today, artists are somewhat limited in their ability to go deeper inside a person's psyche and elicit an absolutely predetermined response. This limitation is set to change with the advent of sophisticated psychological control devices. In the future, artists will be able to perform not only on a canvas or musical instrument, but in the consciousness of the audience itself. It's conceivable that predetermined sets of emotional experiences could be a future art form. Artists might, for example, manipulate emotions alongside established art forms, a la Clockwork Orange, but certainly not for the same questionable ends. For example, imagine listening to Beethoven's Ode to Joy or Moonlight Sonata while having your emotional centers manipulated in sync with the music's mood and tone. You'd be compelled to feel joy when the music is joyful, sadness when the music is sad. The same could be done with film. In fact, last century director Orson Welles, who was greatly influenced by German expressionist filmmaking, directed movies in which the subjective expression of inner experiences was emphasized, Touch of Evil, for example. In the 1960s, Alfred Hitchcock, also a student of expressionism, went a step further by creating and editing sequences in a way that was synchronized with subjective perception, such as the quick-cut shower sequence in Psycho. In the future, audiences could share emotional experiences with a film's protagonist. Imagine watching Saving Private Ryan, Titanic, or Gone with the Wind in such a manner. The experience would be unbelievably visceral, nothing like today's experience of sitting back and watching. The beauty of such experiences is that sophisticated virtual reality technology isn't required, just the control mechanisms to alter emotional experience in real time. Of course, some will argue that when artists can directly manipulate emotions, they will have lost a dialogue with their audience, as audience members will simply be feeling exactly what's intended. But this won't necessarily be the case. Rather, audience members will respond to emotional tapestries in unique ways based on their personal experiences, the same way they do now to other art forms. Art has been always about transcending the individual and sharing the subjective experiences of others. The greatest artists thrill us with their stories, endow us with emotional and interpersonal insight, and fill us with joy through beautiful melodies, paintings, and dance. By doing so, they give us a piece of their selves and allow us to venture inside their own minds, even if just for a little bit. In the future, we'll allow them to go even further into ours. George Dvorsky, in an article called Working the Conscious Canvas, the ability to directly alter subjective and emotional experience, will make mental manipulation an art form. That was in Better Humans on December 13th. George is the deputy editor of Better Humans and the president of the Toronto Transhumanist Association. Finally, in honor of Rummy Rumsfeld, who's having a lot of problems on Capitol Hill because he's basically a jerk and has screwed up Iraq, and even conservatives can't stand to defend him anymore, I thought I'd play this little piece by Scooter from RadioForAll.net. It's called H.S. Rumsfeld.
Well, I think the way to think about that is that, because I tend to be conservative and cautious, if you go from a transition period and then you go to something other than that, the wonderful opportunity to do that, every country in my adult lifetime, we've seen in that transition period there's untidiness. And there's no question but that that's not anyone's choice. On the other hand, one can understand the pent-up feelings that may result from people who've had members of their family killed, and the coalition forces are doing that. Let me say one other thing. I picked up a newspaper today, and I couldn't believe it. I read 8 headlines that talked about chaos, violence, unrest, and it just was henny-penny, the sky is falling. I've never seen anything like it. And here is a country that's being liberated. Here are people who are going from being repressed and held under the thumb of a vicious dictator, and they're free. And all this newspaper could do, with 8 or 10 headlines, they showed a man bleeding, a civilian who they claimed we had shot, one thing after another. It's just unbelievable.
To the bottom, I go back to the top of the slide, and I stop and I turn and I go for a ride, and I get to the bottom and I see you again. Yeah, yeah.
And here is a country that's being liberated.
Do you? Don't you want me to make it?
Yeah.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts with me, Dr. J, you can contact me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Or you can read my Change Surfing columns at betterhumans.com or check out the collaborative Cyborg Democracy blog I participate in at cyborgdemocracy.net. Or you can read my new book, Citizen Cyborg. For more details about Citizen Cyborg, visit cyborgdemocracy.net. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the AInfos radio project. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.